Blood on the Tracks is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis. Phil Spector was a musical genius, one of the most successful record producers of all time. He is now sitting behind bars serving a 19 years to life sentence for murder. This is his story, told by his so-called friends.
This is Special Agent Paul Ramon with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Working case number 004-10-7419. Case subject is Spector Philip Harvey. This information pertains to a period ending February 3, 2003. Interview subject is Clarkson Lana. Interview number 3-46-205-766. Spirit Confessional. Recall number 9. October 1, 2008.
I didn't even know him. I didn't know him at all. I mean, I got to know him. A little. I got to know what he wanted me to know. I was on a need-to-know basis with Phil Spector. He was in control of his own narrative. It was just the two of us. The two of us in the middle of the night. In his car. In his castle. We had just met for the first time, and the last time. Some would say he told me too much. Others would say he didn't tell me enough. Some would say I shouldn't have gone with him. Others would say I did the right thing. But no one knows, really. No one really knows what went down that night besides me and Phil. The only thing everyone else was privy to was the blood. The blood on the chair. The blood on the stairs. The blood on the floor of the foyer, and the blood on the tracks.
Chapter 9. Phil Spector and Lana Clarkson.
I didn't know who he was at first. I thought he was one of those guys who walks into the place after midnight, some bimbo on his arm. Slips someone a $50 bill, tries to get a table. Acts like he owns the place, but clearly doesn't own the place. He's not even a member. Just some schmo trying to impress the gold digger by his side. Bad hairpiece. Wearing dark sunglasses inside at 1 a.m. Drunk like it's the first time in his life he's been drunk. Dumb grin on his face. A jabroni. So I didn't let him through. The foundation room at the House of Blues is strictly members only. And that's a $3,500 annual fee, right? I didn't know this guy from Adam. I'd never seen him. He wasn't getting past me. I had been the hostess at the House of Blues on the Strip for a while. Longer than I would have liked to admit, to be honest. So I knew all the regulars. I made the daily commute from my place in Venice. Shifts usually ran from 6 at night till 2 in the morning. It was a gig to fill in the gaps. A necessary evil. Something to earn some steady cash while I continued busting my ass with casting calls and auditions and grabbing whatever roles I could grab. I was 40. It's not like I was all washed up. Far from it. But I found myself in a valley at the time. A valley in the natural ebb and flow of an actor's professional life. And when you find yourself in a valley, you scramble and do what you gotta do to pull yourself back out. Find that next mountain. Every actor needs a side hustle every now and then.
I didn't even know him.
This particular side hustle was a humbling experience and occasionally humiliating. I was waiting on high rollers, A-level types, B-level types. The kind of Hollywood player who could afford to shell out an annual fee just to walk into the joint. And so other actors would show up to the Foundation Room. Actors who had beat me out for this role or that role. And I had to seat them. Show them to their table. Wait on them. I hated that moment. That moment when the person I was about to seat would put their hand gently on my arm and patronizingly say, "Hey, aren't you Lana Clarkson?" And not because they had seen me in Barbarian Queen either.
Barbarian Queen. No man can touch her naked steel.
It wasn't the recognition that a fan has when they meet a star. It was the recognition that a winner has when they run into a loser. So there I was, not wanting to get recognized by all the wrong people. And it turns out I wasn't recognizing the right people. I was ready to toss this guy out on his ass, wipe the shit-eating grin right off his little Lord Fauntleroy face. He asked to speak to a manager. One of the waitresses happened to be walking by at that moment and saw what was going on. She pulled me aside. "Don't you know who that is?" she whispered. I shook my head. "Phil Spector." Didn't ring a bell. "The record producer."
"I didn't know him at all."
Still nothing. "Da-do, run, run. Guy walks around his castle in Alhambra in the dark wearing a Batman costume." I had heard about that. It was in some Time magazine article or something. Then the waitress started to hum the melody of that song and it clicked. I turned to face the man I was about to send back into the street, menus in hand. "Mr. Spector," I said. "My apologies. I almost didn't recognize you. This way to your table." My face must have been beet red. I wanted to go crawl back into the kitchen, find a stainless steel table to hide under, and just die.
"I was on a need-to-know basis with Phil Spector."
The woman he was with? She had that hospitality industry look. Like she had just worked a grueling, demeaning shift already that night, and now was being taken out on the town by some guy who barely knew her. I called him like I saw him. Whether you're an actress or a hostess, you get good at that sort of thing in the thick of the Hollywood jungle. She just gave me one of those half smiles. The kind that simultaneously says thank you and fuck you. When they sat down, I could tell there was trouble in paradise already. They weren't really talking that much to each other. His eyes would follow me every time I walked by. And I didn't know if it was because he thought I was an idiot for not recognizing him, or if he was turned on by the fact that I didn't recognize him. I'd find out soon enough.
"Someone said he didn't tell me enough."
He ordered a Bacardi. And she had a glass of water. That really set him off. He was there to drink, to get shitty and have a good time. And it pissed him off that a woman on his arm would rather be back home in deep, blissful sleep than tie one on with him. He started to yell at her, loud enough that we could all hear him. He was like,
"Get a fucking drink."
And she just waved him off like he was a fruit fly trying to land on the rim of her glass. It wasn't too long after he raised his voice that his driver showed up at the hostess stand. He said Mr. Spector asked him to take his date home, but Mr. Spector was going to stay a little longer. After his date was gladly chaperoned outside, he tried to order more drinks. But the guy was so drunk, and it was at least 2, if not later, and we had to wrap it up. He paid for the $8 Bacardi and the $5 water and left a tip that was like $400. And then he asked me to join him for a drink as I was walking by his table again. After he had already been told the bar was closed. At first, I thought he was just working an angle to get another drink. That maybe if he could convince one of the staff members to join him, the taps would flow for him once more. So I sat down with him for a moment. He asked me to accompany him back to his place in Alhambra, his castle, as he put it. I politely declined. A guy who walks around in the dark with a Batman costume wants me to come over, and what? Do I play Catwoman or maybe Poison Ivy? No, thank you. I hardly knew the guy. I wasn't about to get myself too deep. But he was persistent. He kept asking. I kept declining. And then he compromised. He asked if he could drive me to my car. Well, actually, if his driver could drive me to my car. You know, once he was back from dropping off the date at her place. We got in the elevator together. He turned his head slightly towards me and said,
"I bet you won't forget me again."
He was buying time. He was gonna try to butter me up in his car, get me to change my mind about going to his place. I said to myself, "Lana, get in his car and see how you feel in a few minutes. Maybe turn this humdrum night-seating A-list clientele on the strip on its ear. Maybe. Maybe not." It was close to 2:30 a.m. when I clocked out of the House of Blues and followed Phil into the cool evening air. My mind was not made up yet. I was always in the background, a face in the crowd, always walking on screen just to walk off. Sometimes the roles were minor. Fast Times at Ridgemont High was like that. I had a line, at least. "Hi." That was the line. There were no lines in Scarface. Scarface was minor. I'm there for a second or two, helping to fill the frame as part of the ensemble, and then I'm gone. The bigger roles were always the lower profile pictures. The Roger Corman stuff. The ones where I was a buxom warrior in a fur leotard doing the female Conan the Barbarian thing. "I'll be no man's slave and no man's whore." Xena, Lucy Lawless, they were all inspired by that one. I like to think I paved the way in a cult classic kind of way. I never got used to the nudity. I always felt it was beneath me. But it was a boy's town and a boy's game, and I did what I had to do to move forward. But I never took any shit from anyone. These nude publicity shots of me wound up in some paper in San Francisco, and I lost it.
"The She-Devil strikes back."
I went right to Roger Corman himself and demanded to know what the hell was the big idea. He took me to the publicity department so that I could bear witness to his verbal beatdown. See, I admired a classier Hollywood than the Hollywood of the 1980s. I'm talking Marilyn Monroe, Jane Mansfield. I met Lana Turner once, the epitome of Hollywood class. Of course, she's the actress I'm named after. We both had the same hairdresser, so we were introduced sometime in the early 80s, before I had landed much of anything. That Lana hadn't acted in years, but she still carried herself like a star. The glow, the poise, the class. I like to think I inherited more than a name, that I took on the whole aura of a golden age, a bygone era. Maybe that's what Phil saw in me that night. Maybe I was an echo to Phil, something that called out to him from afar, Something that brought him back to a place that he never wanted to leave. The more he talked to me in the car on the ride back to his place in Alhambra, the more I learned that he was a soul that was stuck in time. His head was in the 60s. Time kept pushing ahead, but Phil didn't go along for that ride. He was a mono man living in a quadrophonic world. Hang on, I should explain. You're probably thinking, wait, she told him she wasn't going home with him. I changed my mind. I did accept the invitation to go back to his castle after all. He was relentless. What can I say? He made me an offer I couldn't refuse. When we left the House of Blues, Phil was walking like a slow-motion pinball banging around a machine. He was feeling no pain, I'll put it that way. I helped him into the Mercedes, and his driver, Adriano, this real nice kid, he helped him get inside the back seat. Inside the car, he invited me, he begged me to come home with him a few more times. The third time he asked me, right as we were pulling up to my parked car, is the moment I changed my mind. What's the worst that could happen, right? Because at first his shtick was a little endearing. He seemed to really want my company. I couldn't really tell if it was a romantic thing or not. I think he just didn't want to be alone. I knew I was the third woman he'd been with that night. He told me that. He'd been all over LA, spent hours haunting this place and that place, dinner, drinks. He told me what they'd eaten and how nothing was really going the way he wanted. The other women weren't good company, but he could tell I was good company. That was the kind of minimal flattery he offered up during the 30-minute ride from Hollywood to Alhambra. We took the 101 to the 10. It was so late the traffic wasn't a complete nuisance. The talk quickly turned to Phil just talking about Phil. It was either because he was extremely intoxicated or he was nervous. Or perhaps he just liked to talk about himself. He was intrigued that I didn't know much about him, and he wanted to give me a Phil Spector crash course right there in the car. Huh. Phil Spector 101 on the 101. He told me about the Righteous Brothers, about the Beatles and John and George, about Ike and Tina, about the Ramones. But he didn't talk about them as if they were his friends. I don't even know that he looked back on his time with any of them fondly. He talked about them to talk about them, to name drop. He told me he recorded Elvis and that the Beach Boys wouldn't have been the Beach Boys without him. That modern pop music as we know it would have ceased to exist. The more he talked, the more the initial appeal of his personality started to wear thin. I wondered if I had made a mistake after all. And then he told me about his castle. He didn't call it a house or even a mansion. It was his castle. He said, you gotta see it, you know?
Just wait till you see it.
He was trying to explain the architecture and a staircase and something about suits of armor. That's the part when I wondered if he had drifted off into loopy land, talking about suits of armor. Like, who the fuck has suits of armor at their house? The more he described his place, the more I thought I was walking into a droopy dog cartoon. We drove through the suburbia of Alhambra. You know, the strip malls, the bungalows. It was a sleepy place. A sleepy place, especially so late at night. But there was really nothing to write home about there. I actually caught myself wondering what it was about the place he liked so much. We got to these huge iron gates, so big that Adriano had to get out of the car and push them open with his bare hands. We drove up further, through the trees, like we were headed into a jungle. There was a gradual incline, and then it cleared, and there was this amazing water fountain. And there it was. Phil's home. The castle.
It was just the two of us in the middle of the night.
It was incredible in the darkness. I could only wonder what it looked like in the light. You could see everything from up there. The whole damn town. You could probably see even right down into LA if you looked hard enough. But I didn't want to look around at the flora and fauna at 3 o'clock in the morning. I wanted to see if his castle was everything Phil had made it out to be.
We'll be right back after this
word.
I didn't know there was a gun until we got inside. There were many guns inside, actually. But you know that, don't you? You would think that a guy who had so many guns and is so in love with guns would have actually said something about it on that 30-minute drive. You gotta think that the subject of guns was somewhere in his mind at the time, that it was always on his mind. He didn't utter one word about his collection of firearms as we rode to his place. Looking back, that was a red flag. God, I was so naive about the whole thing.
Some would say I shouldn't have gone with him.
However, I'll admit I was more than a bit starstruck in the moment. Starstruck and a little drunk. The tequila and Vicodin combo offered some smooth sailing on the stranger danger front. It's not like I hadn't been in the presence of top-shelf celebrity before. I'd hung out with Jack Nicholson, Warren Beatty, Don Henley. But this was different. This was a whole other level of spectacle. The pageantry of it, the bravado. It was this giant French chateau-style manifestation of Phil's ego. Don't think I had missed that ego. From the moment he walked up to the hostess stand at the House of Blues to the moment he asked me to come home with him to all the Cliff Notes war stories he told me in the car. Let's just say, if his house had been any smaller, I would have been disappointed. But this thing didn't disappoint. Turrets, spires. There was an outdoor terrace on top of the thing. As we stepped out of the car, Phil took a cue from my gasps and comments and told me he had bought it for $1.1 million just like 5 years ago. He threw that number out there in a way he threw out references to the Beatles and Elvis Presley. He wanted to make sure you were still paying attention. You know, paying attention to the biggest fucking deal in the room. Fucking Phil Spector. He told me they called it the Pyrenees Castle. Some guy from France built it in the 20s.
He was in control of his own narrative.
His voice was slurred as he told me all of this. I had to help him walk, especially up the dramatic stairs that led to the front door. I told Adriano I had it under control. I'd made that codependent drunken walk up a flight of stairs many a time, thank you very much. And so he drove the car around back where Phil liked it. Phil pushed open the wide front doors, and it was like we were stepping back in time. The place certainly hadn't been updated to reflect any sort of 2003 aesthetic. There was a marble foyer, crystal chandeliers, a bunch of outdated red carpet that ran up the staircase. There was a Picasso sketch next to a John Lennon sketch. There wasn't one suit of armor. There were two suits of armor, just propped up on either side of a doorway.
I half expected the things to come to life and chase me around the place.
He told me there were 9 bedrooms, 10 bathrooms, but it was just him living there. Just him, adrift in all this space. Don't you get lonely here all by yourself? I asked him. I probably asked him 3 or 4 more times. Every time I asked him, I saw him wince a little. like the idea of loneliness hurt him. But it was obviously his reality.
Damn, must be lonely.
He shook off the questions by just rattling off more details about the place. Did I know there was a wet bar there? And a hair salon? Not one, but two kitchens? We drank some more. Bumbled around some more. Phil didn't stop talking. And then at some point, he said,
"Take a look at this."
He had opened the drawer of a dresser in the foyer. There was a gun in it. He asked me if I liked guns. Asked me if I ever shot a gun. He pulled the gun out of the drawer and started to play around with it. It was small, a revolver. He spun it around and flipped it over like it was hot to the touch. Didn't really look like he knew what he was doing. I had no idea at the time. No idea that he had pulled a gun on Debbie Harry, that he pulled a gun on the Ramones. He shot a gun at John Lennon. That he locked his wife in a closet. That he held Leonard Cohen and many others hostage in his own house. I didn't know any of those things. I was fully out of that loop. I had no idea I was yet another in a long line of unsuspecting visitors to Phil's house or studio who got a pistol shoved in their face. I don't think that either of us knew that I would be the last. The last time I saw Phil Spector, he was holding a little revolver up to my face. He had to reach to get up there. I was so tall, and he was so short. He was holding a little revolver up to my face and daring me to kiss it.
February 3rd, 2003, 1700 Grandview Avenue, Alhambra, California. It was around 5 in the morning when Adriano D'Souza heard the pop. He was sitting in the driver's seat of a black Mercedes limo, parked around the back of the Pyrenees Castle, the 8,700 square foot Alhambra home that offered a bird's eye view of the San Gabriel Valley from atop its isolated knoll. Both the Mercedes and the castle belonged to Adriano's boss, Phil Spector. The sound made Adriano nervous. It was loud and came out of nowhere to disrupt the idyllic pre-dawn calm. It was too loud to be a plate hitting the kitchen floor, too intense to be a slammed door. Adriano was equally nervous because he wasn't Phil's regular driver. He was the filling guy. Dylan was the regular driver, but it was Dylan's night off. Adriano was in the U.S. on a student visa from Brazil and picked up the part-time gig for some easy cash. For the most part, it was a cush gig. Sometimes it even seemed too easy. Adriano spent a small percentage of every pinch-hit shift anxious that something off, something bad would happen on his night, on his watch. It would be just his luck. The evening had been exceptionally busy. Adriano had driven Phil all over LA, first to Beverly Hills with Roni Davis, someone Phil knew from high school. They ate at a place called Grill on the Alley. That was around 7 p.m. After dinner, Phil had Adriano drive Roni home and returned to the Grill, where Phil asked a waitress, Kathy Sullivan, to hit the town with him. Adriano drove them to Trader Vic's and then to Dan Tana's. Phil had drinks at each stop, and by the time they got to their third location, the House of Blues on the Sunset Strip, Phil was slurring his words. It was around 3 a.m. when Adriano returned to the Alhambra Castle with Phil's new acquaintance, Lana Clarkson, in tow. After Lana helped Phil wobble up the steps and into the house, Adriano parked the Mercedes out back and debated allowing himself to catch a few winks before he was needed again. The sound from inside the house at 5 a.m. snapped Adriano to attention. There was no way he was catching even a few winks after that sound. It popped. It was loud. Something was wrong. Something was off. Adriano opened the door of the Mercedes and stepped outside. was cold out. Cold for Alhambra in February, at least. About 40 degrees. Adriano could see the breath escape from his mouth. He rubbed his hands together to maintain the warm feeling of the limo's climate-controlled interior, and for a moment he heard nothing more. Nothing followed the dramatic sound, just the hushed sounds of the world slowly coming to life for another day. Maybe he had imagined the whole thing. And then, the back door of the castle flung open. Some birds in a nearby tree were startled and flapped away. Phil Spector tumbled out of the castle. His eyes were wide, his face frozen in shock and confusion. He was still dressed in the same clothes from the night before, and Adriano wondered if he was still drunk. As Phil got closer, Adriano saw the revolver in Phil's right hand. He saw the blood. Adriano looked past Phil through the open door and saw the woman who just hours before had been in the limo, Lana Clarkson, slumped on top of a chair in the foyer. Her blonde hair hung in the air. Her long legs were sharp angles. Phil got closer to Adriano, who stood still halfway between the Mercedes and the castle. Phil looked at him, dead in the eye. At first he said nothing, just the thousand-yard dead-eye stare. And then he made a confession. "I think I killed somebody." Adriano stood in shock. He wasn't sure that he had heard what he thought he had heard. Had he heard a gunshot? Did Phil Spector just confess to murder? "What happened, sir?" Adriano asked. Phil didn't answer. He didn't make a sound. All he did was calmly shrug his shoulders, and then he turned around to direct the thousand-yard dead-eye stare back into the house and at Lana Clarkson's body. Detective Mark Lilienfield's affidavit, the one he filed with the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, gave a vivid account of the scene the first responders found inside the ostentatious home. The victim, Lana Clarkson, was slumped in a chair in the foyer. She was dressed in black. Her leopard print purse dangled from her limp shoulder. She had a single gunshot to her mouth. Broken teeth were strewn on the floor of the foyer and even made their way onto the stairway nearby. Under Lana's leg was a .38 caliber Colt revolver, blue steel. Of the six possible shots in the weapon, five of them still had live ammo locked and loaded, but the sixth was spent. All signs pointed to one conclusion. The police investigation, the coroner's report, the testimony of Adriano D'Souza and others, and then throw in a quick examination of the host's character, his love of gunplay, the wild ways in which he carried himself, his history of physical and emotional abuse. All signs pointed to Phil Spector. That famed record producer, an infamous recluse, whose life was now spattered with blood. Everyone was privy to it. The blood on his chair, the blood on his stairs, the blood on the floor of his foyer, and the blood on the tracks. This episode of Blood on the Tracks is brought to you by 27 Club, a podcast that I host on musicians who died at the age of 27. Season 2 featuring Jim Morrison is now available, as is Season 1 with 12 episodes featuring Jimi Hendrix. Subscribe to the 27 Club on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, this episode was also brought to you by Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast also hosted by yours truly. Episodes on the Rolling Stones, Jerry Lee Lewis, Cardi B, The Grateful Dead, Jay-Z, Prince, and many, many more are all waiting for you right now. Just search Disgraceland on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcast. All right, this episode of Blood on the Tracks was written by Zeth Lundy and scored and mixed by Matt Bowden. Hosted by me, Jake Brennan. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker and Henry Lunetta. This episode featured Ruby Rose Fox as Lana Clarkson. Blood on the Tracks is produced by myself for Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the Blood on the Tracks series page. If you like what you hear, please be sure to subscribe to Blood on the Tracks on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio app, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to win a free Blood on the Tracks poster designed by Nate Gonzalez, then leave a review for Blood on the Tracks on Apple Podcasts. You can hashtag Blood on the Tracks on social media, leave your review there, and we'll pick two winners each week and announce them on the Double Elvis Instagram page. That's at Double Elvis. Go ahead and give that a follow. All right, as always, you can find me blabbing about other crazy rock stars on Disgraceland and 27 Club, and you can talk to me per usual on Instagram and Twitter at DisgracelandPod. Rock and roll.
Oh, dang it.